This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Imagine there's no heaven, no hell below us, above us only sky. This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker. This is the June 29th, 2013 show. Free Thought Radio originates from Madison, Wisconsin. We broadcast here in Madison, and you can also listen to the show streamed through iHeartRadio at 11 a.m. on Saturdays. This show also broadcasts from stations in other states, including Missouri, California, New York, Michigan, and very soon we'll be broadcasting in Central Texas. And of course, many of you are listening to the podcast, which is posted a few days later. Annie Laurie Gaylor is not here today. She was ready to get in the car and drive over to do the show, and we worked on the show together, but she said she just couldn't. There's so many pressures, so many deadlines. She's happy to do it all, but the ad rep from the Scientific American came in. We've got the building expansion pressures going on right now. She's doing a lot of media, and we're planning a trip to Dublin. And she says, I can't. Can you do it on your own? So I'll try to do half a show, half a good show without her being here. But she'll be back next week. Next week, we'll be talking with Jerry DeWitt. Free Thought Radio, as most of you listeners know, is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF. You can find us at FFRF.org. And we work to keep religion and government separate. And we do that through lawsuits, through educational activities, through letters to correct violations, of which we talk about a lot on this show. And we'll talk about some today. But we also have a second purpose, and that's to educate the public about the views of non-believers. Most FFRF members are atheists or agnostics, with a sprinkling of other labels that we don't really care what people call themselves. But we are people. We are the fastest growing segment of America right now by religious identification of the nuns, people who do not have a belief in a God, mainly for intellectual reasons and also for some moral reasons. Intellectually, there's no evidence. There's no good argument. There's no agreement among believers. There's no need for a belief in a God. And of course, morally, religious belief has been dangerous, especially when government and religion get mixed. So we hope someday you will join us and become a member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation to keep fighting for state church separation and for free thought. Today, June 29th, is the birthday of the songwriter Frank Lesser. Lesser was a major songwriter. Frank Lesser was born in 1910. He wrote the musical Guys and Dolls, which includes the songs Luck Be a Lady, I'll Know If I Were a Bell. He wrote the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which has The Brotherhood of Man and the song I Believe in You. Frank Lesser was not a believer. We talked with his daughter, Susan, last year on this show, and she told us that her dad's family was Jewish by blood only, but not by thought or deed. No religion was practiced at home. Frank Lesser wrote the lyrics to the song Heart and Soul. Heart and Soul, I Fell in Love with You. And he wrote the words and music to many other songs, including Baby, It's Cold Outside, I Don't Want to Walk Without You, Baby, which Irving Berlin said was the best song he had ever heard. And that's quite a compliment coming from Irving Berlin. He wrote Slow Boat to China, Standing on the Corner, Two Sleepy People, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve, and the music for the movie Hans Christian Andersen. Listen today, and during our show, you will hear some of Frank Lesser's music. During the second half of today's show, we're going to talk with Daniel Dennett, our favorite philosopher. Daniel Dennett has a new book out. It's called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. It's a book about how to think about thinking. And it's one of the most enjoyable philosophy books I have ever read. Well, I'm about almost halfway through it, so there's more enjoyment to come. In the news, we have some victories to report. Well, I guess I should say I have, because Annie Laurie has sent me here on my own. I have some victories to report and a loss to report. First, we're making some headway in complaints. Our interns and attorneys are working real hard. There was a top of the fold story out of Tucson just this week about one of our complaints. The story says, not on public property. That's the demand of an out-of-state group making over something on Tucson's west side. The organization is arguing that a group of mountainside shrines need to go, but the city doesn't plan to lift a finger. The shrines are Our Lady of Guadalupe. They're around the southeast base of A Mountain. That's a capital A Mountain, where Mission Road meets Star Pass. They include two hidden grottos, as well as a man-made shell covering a statue of Mary. The Freedom from Religion Foundation sent a letter to the city of Tucson stating that those shrines need to be moved because right now they're on public property. A local member of our group in Tucson first brought the concern to the Freedom from Religion Foundation. Annie Laurie said, it's always a big deal when the First Amendment is violated. If we want to honor the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, we have to uphold it. The letter we sent argued that the mountain display confers government endorsement of Christianity in an extremely public way. But some other Tucsonians disagree. This mountain, as very many mountains, is very sacred, said Cardenas, a native Tucsonian. There's earthquakes, there's crime, there's murder, she said. If you want to be focused on something that saves our soul, why take that away from us? She said the shrines are a reminder of local culture, tradition, and faith. It signifies who we are, she said. But Annie Laurie said, and she's quoted in the paper saying, there's always a quote-unquote good reason to make an exception and violate the provision separating religion from government. I don't actually see any good reason here. I mean, it's just litter. It belongs on private property. And our letter suggested that don't tear it down, just move it to ample private and church grounds. The city said, we've looked at the shrine and determined it does not pose any public safety or health issue, and there's no plans to remove it. Of course, that misses the point. We're not complaining about its public safety or health. It's about its constitutionality. So, you know, it's too early to talk about a lawsuit on something like this. We get thousands of complaints like this around the country, but we would hope that with some more legal pressure, the city would see that it would make more sense to move those shrines to a more appropriate location, like a church or public private property, where those people can advertise their views. A victory out of the Freedom from Religion Foundation about immigration. Here's from our press release at FFRF.org. FFRF has successfully stood up for equal rights of the non-religious by forcing the U.S. Office of Customs and Immigration Services to strike down an unconstitutional requirement for religious documentation that would have barred an atheist from becoming a citizen. A woman named Margaret Dowdy, she's a 30-year resident of the U.S. She's also an atheist. She applied to the Houston office of the U.S. Customs Immigration Services to become a citizen. Dowdy is 64 years old. She's lived in the United States for more than 30 years as a permanent resident, running a nonprofit adult literacy organization, and she's been honored by Queen Elizabeth II for her service to education. All applicants must take an oath, if you want to become a citizen, to bear arms for the United States before full citizenship is granted. Exceptions to this oath are permitted for those who object to war based on, quote, religious training and belief. Freedom from Religion Foundation attorney Andrew Seidel wrote a letter on June the 14th noting that U.S. Supreme Court precedent does not require any religious test to receive an exemption to bear arms. It only requires a deeply held belief. Ms. Doty asked for that exemption based on her deeply held non-religious beliefs. She said, I'm sure the law would never require a 64-year-old woman to bear arms, but if I'm required to answer this question, I cannot lie. I must be honest. I would not be willing to bear arms. Since my youth, I've had a firm, fixed, and sincere objection to participation in war in any form or the bearing of arms I deeply and sincerely believe that it is not moral or ethical to take another person's life. Well, at first, the Houston office admitted the sincerity of her beliefs, but in violation of the precedents cited by Seidel, still required her to submit religious documentation. It had to be like a letter from your religious congregation. Well, failure to submit the document could have resulted in a denial of her application. But she did get in touch with FFRF. We protested this illegal burden in strong language. It's shocking that the USCIS would not be aware that a non-religious yet deeply held belief would be sufficient to attain this exemption. So either the officers in Houston are inept or they're discriminating. So on June 20th, Doty was informed that her case was escalated to the highest level at the request for evidence was withdrawn. So this is a victory. In a phone conversation with Seidel, she expressed her gratitude for our prompt action in defense of atheists. So you can become a U.S. citizen without believing in God. We have some more news to talk about. The Boy Scouts ad. And we're going to talk about the Big Mountain Jesus decision out of Montana. And in the second half of our show today, we'll be talking with the philosopher Daniel Dennett. So stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker. Annie Laurie Gaylor is, of course, not able to be with me today. So maybe next week she can be, she can talk twice as much next week. So stay tuned. This is Dan Barker. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. Welcome back to Radio as Godless as Our Constitution. I'm Dan Barker. This is Free Thought Radio. And Annie Laurie had to sit this one out, but she'll be back next week. We told you last week about the Boy Scout ads that we have been running. There was last Sunday in the New York Times an ad about the Boy Scouts of America that the Freedom From Religion Foundation ran, a quarter-page ad. It has a picture of a Boy Scout pointing to all these merit badges saying, this one's for swimming, this one's for woodcraft, this one's for religious bigotry. And we told you last week about how we congratulated the Boy Scouts for lifting their ban on homosexual young people, although not leaders. And yet our ad points out, well, why are you still discriminating? You're going so far to lift the ban on gay members. Why? What about the atheists? Every Boy Scout has to swear an oath to duty to God, and that's unfair to the students and to the families that are good people who want to join. I might have wanted to join, and a Boy Scout leader told me, no, I was not good enough, nor my grandson were good enough to join the Boy Scouts of America. So this ad itself has run in other papers, and it's generated some news. The ad itself has generated some news and commentary around the country, including in Houston. And then on the Christian Post, which is a Christian religious webpage, they reported on our ad. And they quoted a man named Rob Schwartzwalder of the Family Research Council. The Family Research Council is a right-wing Christian organization that is anti-gay rights. They want essentially a Christian nation to go back to what they think was the Christian founding of our country. But ironically, this Rob Schwartzwalder of the Family Research Council agreed with us because he's angry at the Boy Scouts of America for bending their rules. He said this, and the Christian Post quoted him saying, the bottom line is, scouting has now removed any logical or legal basis for protecting against the inclusion of openly gay scoutmasters. So in a sense, this group, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, is perfectly correct. So the religious right is chastising the Boy Scouts, saying, see, you've opened the floodgates. Look, if you're going to allow gays in, guess what's next? It's a slippery slope. You're going to have to allow atheists and agnostic students to join the Boy Scouts. Well, hear, hear, as Annie Laurie would say, hear, hear. Now, we have also talked about a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit of ours in Montana about the Jesus statue on public property, federal property on a ski slope called Big Mountain. And we lost that case this week, but we are going to appeal that case. The judge issued a very bad decision, and Annie, Laurie, and I were working late the other night, and a phone call came into the office from a man in Montana. We didn't know that the decision had come down. And, you know, we get a lot of crank calls, a lot of crank mail. By the way, if you do call us and you want to harass us, we'll listen once. We'll listen to what you have to say once. But if you keep calling back, we will very politely put you on hold, and you can listen to our free thought music on hold as you rant and rave. But anyway, Annie Laurie was bracing herself for another crank call. But this guy surprised her by saying that he just heard the news that FFRF had lost our case, saying that it's incredible to him that the facts were so clear that the Jesus statue did not belong on public land, and then he wanted to join the Freedom from Religion Foundation. So other people have shared our dismay and our shock that we lost, this time not on standing, the judge actually upheld our standing, we lost on the merits with an Obama appointee. Briefly, and you can read more about this at our website under ffrf.org/news. Briefly, the judge said that a shrine to Jesus has a secular purpose and that a ski slope on federal property is like a museum. We've talked about the Lemon Test after the recent death of Alton Lemon, and this Lemon Test requires a government action to have a secular purpose. Yes, although the application from the Knights of Columbus says in writing that the purpose was to erect a shrine to Jesus, the judge said the secular purpose was simply to lease federal land. The judge said if the government's actions are motivated in part by a secular purpose, well, then it's okay. The judge went on to say, well, yeah, some people are upset. It's a religious shrine, but some people are, you know, some people want to worship there, but most people aren't, so he was going to let it stay. So stay tuned for more. Here's a brief story out of KAJ 18 in Kalispell.
A federal judge says the statue of Jesus Christ on Big Mountain is unquestionably a religious symbol, but he rules the Forest Service was within the law when it granted a new permit for the statue more than a year ago. That's the ruling from U.S. District Court Judge Dana Christensen, who issued the summary judge on Monday in favor of the Forest Service in the case brought by the Freedom from Religion Foundation. FFRF had filed suit against the Forest Service and the Knights of Columbus for permitting the religious statue on federal land at the summit of Big Mountain. In the 28-page ruling, Christensen wrote, quote, "To some, Big Mountain Jesus is offensive, and to others, it represents only a religious symbol. But the court suspects that most who happen to encounter Big Mountain Jesus, it neither offends nor inspires," end quote. The statue was first erected in the early 1950s in tribute to World War II veterans.
Well, we will appeal this bad decision because the judge was off the point. The federal government is endorsing religion by putting that religiously purposed icon on public property. And we would complain even if it was Buddhism or if it was Islam or if it was Hinduism or whatever the religion is. Here's a song off of the Freedom from Religion Foundation's album, Beware of Dogma, that talks about the potential possible icons that might be on public property like this.
Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. And that's good enough for me.
We will pray to Aphrodite, even though she's rather flighty. And they say she wears no nightie, and that's good enough for me.
Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. And that's good enough for me.
We will pray with those Egyptians, build pyramids to put our crypts in, cover subways with inscriptions, and that's good enough for me.
Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion, and that's good enough for me.
Oh, old Odin, we will follow, and in fighting we will wallow, till we end up in Valhalla, and that's good enough for me.
Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time give me that old-time religion, and that's good enough for me.
Let me follow dear old Buddha, for there is nobody cuter. He comes in plastic, wood, or pewter, and that's good enough for me.
Give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion.
Give me that old-time religion. If you want to hear the rest of that song, it's on the Beware of Dogma musical album produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Those words, by the way, were written by Pete Seeger. Stay tuned for more of Free Thought Radio after the break. Philosopher Daniel Dennett.
This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker, and Annie Laurie is off today. She'll be back next week so we can have a full show, not just half a show. Daniel Dennett, we've talked with Daniel Dennett on this show before, and he's spoken at the Freedom From Religion Foundation convention and received an award from us. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher and author, is one of those really rare people. Not only has he written a lot of books that are widely read and influential, but he's one of those people about whom books are written, and that's a totally different level. You can go into the store and find books not just by Dan Dennett, but about Daniel Dennett. He's the author of the book Breaking the Spell, which we talked about a couple years ago on this show, Breaking the Spell of Religion. The book Freedom Evolves, the powerful book Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Dan Dennett is university professor and Austin B. Fletcher professor of philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. Other books include Content and Consciousness, Brainstorms, Elbow Room, The Intentional Stance, Consciousness Explained, another of my favorites, Kinds of Minds, and Brain Children. He also co-edited the book, which I also read, called The Mind's Eye, the capital letter I, The Mind's Eye, with Douglas Hofstadter back in early 1980s. He's written over 300 scholarly articles on various aspects of the mind in such journals as Artificial Intelligence, Behavioral Brain Science, Poetics Today, and the Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism. His most recent book, which I'm reading now, is Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking, an intriguing title. It's by Norton in the U.S. and by Penguin in the U.K. Dan Dennett, his bio says he spends most of his summers on his farm in Maine, where he harvests blueberries, hay, and timber, and makes Normandy cider when he's not sailing. So what a versatile person. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio, Daniel.
It's great to be back, Dan. You spent so much time listening to my books, we won't have much time to talk.
That's right. So now we will end the show. You'll have to just go out and read Dan's books. I'm really impressed by this new book, I have to say, because of how accessible it is.
That was the point.
Yeah, and I love your other writings as well, but tell us about the freshman students and the whole idea behind this book.
Well, for some time I've been thinking that what makes us smart is actually the tools that other people mainly have invented that we use, thinking tools. And I've invented a few of my own, some of them quite elaborate thought experiments, some of them very simple. And I began thinking about how many of those I had to tell people about. And I wanted to sort of demystify the whole business of doing philosophy and say, look, you know, you can do it too if you equip yourself with the right tools. So this is my Uncle Dan's collection of thinking tools for the would-be philosopher. And some of them are very simple. They're just simple tools, like one of my favorites is the surely alarm. I tell my students, anytime you see the word surely, a little bell should ring, ding, alerting you to the fact that this is probably the weakest point in the author's argument. It's not quite so obvious that it goes without saying, and the author doesn't want to argue for it.
It's like a hand,
the wool is being pulled over your eyes.
Or like they're just sort of waving their hand kind of quickly, saying, surely we all know this.
Yeah, sure. Nudge, nudge. Surely.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So one of the funny things is that since the book's come out, I've given talks where I've encouraged people to send me examples of their surely alarm going off and it being a case where, in fact, that was the weak point. I've got a few now. So it really does work. But okay. That's a very simple one. Other ones are quite elaborate thought experiments that take more time to present than we have time for here.
Now, you explain in your book that the book was vetted by not grad students or other philosophers, but by first-year tough students. And surely they're not going to understand this, are they?
Yeah, ding. Well, that was the challenge. I thought, I want this book to be super accessible, and I don't want graduate students or undergraduate majors being my target audience for the read-through. This is something I've done with all my recent books, is do a seminar on the book and have my students hold my feet to the fire and object. Because, you know, graduate students want to impress you, and undergraduate majors are so eager not to reveal that they don't understand something. But you get a bunch of smart freshmen in a room, and they'll ask the tough, embarrassing questions, because they don't know any better yet. And that really makes an ideal test bed for a book like this. And so I simply took the first dozen that signed up, and they had at it. And I was actually amazed at how often they showed me, you think this is clear, Professor Dennett, but it can be clearer. Mm-hmm. You know, creative misunderstandings on their part, which instead of making me angry, I thought, oh, great, I never thought anybody could misunderstand it that way. Mm-hmm. And then it led me to rewrite.
So Daniel and the 12 disciples, was that what it was?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, actually 13 because of a clerical confusion.
Well, you know, I think that's a great tactic. Since you're writing a book for a popular audience, for someone like me, I'm not a trained philosopher. You know, I think I'm conversant, but nothing like you. And so I can pick this book up, and probably that freshman class represents sort of a median of the general popular readership, people who are smart, who care, who are plugged in, but want to learn more.
In fact, I think it's better than that. I think that the only people that don't benefit from this are fellow paid professional philosophers, and that's a very small and arcane group, and they can read it for pleasure and insight too. But so many of my colleagues write books only for their colleagues, and I think that explains largely why so little philosophy that's written these days is read by anybody else.
I went out on the hammock to start reading this book, and I have to say, I was chuckling, I was laughing, I was smiling. This is fun. I mean, when was the last time it was fun to read a philosophy book? So thanks for doing that.
You're welcome. Thank you for saying it.
How many tools are there? It looks to me in the contents like there's 70 or...
There's over 70, yeah. It's hard, you know, how do you count? Some of those little chapters have more than one tool in them, but there's somewhere between 70 and 80, I guess.
What is jootsing? J-O-O-T-S-I-N-G.
Now, that's a term that I got from Doug Hofstadter, and it's an acronym. It stands for jumping out of the system. And it's something we would all like to do, because some of the great creative moves are when you manage to jump out of the system. And you can't teach anybody how to do it, but you can alert them to the fact that this is a great thing to do if you're lucky enough to be able to. And at least if you know about it, if you ever do jump outside the system, you may be able to discover it and recognize that this is something to treasure. You've managed to find a new perspective. I don't recommend you sitting around thinking, well, now let's see, how do I jump out of the system here? That tends not to work. But that's like the advice, buy low and sell high. Great advice, but hard to follow.
I remember when I was a preacher, ordained minister, going through the struggle of reevaluating my faith, not imagining that I was going to end up an atheist at the time, but just going through it. Part of that, I guess I could use the word jutsing. Part of that was kind of getting outside of my system and myself. And, you know, how would I feel if a Muslim in Baghdad were to rise above the culture and think for himself or herself and say, wait a minute, I'm rejecting that. I would have applauded that. And I remember thinking, well, then why should we not equally applaud Christians in the United States who do the same thing? I remember that kind of feeling of getting outside, like John Loftus writes about the outsider test. So that's a good
note. I think that's right. And when you jump outside the system, what you're always doing is simply questioning something which you never thought to question before. That you would think, well, nobody would question that, would they? Well, yeah. Give it a try.
And why not question it? Yeah.
Yeah. The worst that can happen is that you reestablish your confidence in something that everybody else believes anyway.
Your book breaks into, it looks to me like four general groups: tools for thinking about meaning or content, and then for thinking about evolution, and then for thinking about consciousness, my favorite, and then for talking about free will. After the break, Dan, let's continue talking about consciousness a little bit. We're talking with philosophy professor and author Daniel C. Dennett about his brand new book, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. I'm Dan Barker. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker, and Annie Laurie is taking a break this week. She'll be back with us next week to talk with former Pentecostal preacher from Louisiana, Jerry DeWitt, an exciting show, and our 4th of July weekend show as well. But now we're continuing our conversation with philosopher, author Daniel C. Dennett. His newest book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking, one of the most enjoyable books I've read in a long time, with more than 70 tools for thinking. And I wanted to remind you, Dan, I think I sent you an email about this, but there was a movie out this year with Tina Fey called Admission.
And I haven't seen that.
In one of the scenes, this student is interviewing to get into Princeton. And so during the interview, they tell this kid, tell me about yourself. And the student says, what do you mean by self? Do you mean self as in the center of narrative gravity?
Wonderful.
So you're in the movies.
Whoa, that's great.
Yeah. So that what is that? Is that a meme? What is that? That phrase
that's
is
a
now,
meme, yes.
It's become a part of culture, and now you're in popular culture. tell us a little bit about consciousness, and what are some of the tools for thinking about consciousness?
Well, consciousness is everybody's favorite mystery now that we've pretty well cleared up scientifically all the other great. We understand how procreation happens, how reproduction happens, how we have a pretty good handle on how life got started and how gravity works and all the rest of this, how light works. But consciousness is the last great puzzler, the stumper. And for that very reason, a lot of people inflate it. They want it. They really don't want consciousness explained. They want to make sure that the phenomenon is, to use the technical term, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Well, consciousness might instead be a bag of tricks, like just about everything else in nature. And it's very hard for people to see that that might be so. So one of the things that my tools are designed to show is how we might take consciousness and divide and conquer, break it up into its parts, and show that it's wonderful. It's flippin' wonderful, but it isn't that wonderful. It's not so wonderful that it can't be explained with neurosciences and evolution. evolution plays a big role because, go back a few million years, there wasn't any consciousness, and now there is. So how did it arise and why?
Well, one of the
good questions.
One of the tools you mentioned, I think it's one of the tools in your book because it stuck with me. You know, I think we pretty much agree that the homunculus has been debunked. There is no little person in the brain because otherwise, what's in its brain and what's in its brain? But you suggest an alternative hypothesis, what you call a sorta homunculus. Did I get that right?
Yeah, and a cascade of homunculi. Let me expand on that. Everybody knows that, oh, you got a homunculus in your theory. They think this is a clearly, it bankrupts your theory because you've just got a little man in there, and what's going on in a little man's brain, and does he have a little man in his brain, and so forth, ad infinitum. Well, that would certainly be bad. That would be a postponement of theory, not any kind of theory. But what about if you took a whole human being, a whole Homo sapiens, and divvied up that Homo sapiens brain into a bunch of lesser entities, proper parts that were specialists? No one of them knows everything or is in charge of everything or perceives everything, but they specialize in calculating different parts of the perceptual scene and keeping track of certain sorts of memory jobs and so forth. And then what about what's inside their brains? More homunculi, but with even simpler jobs, so that you don't get an infinite regress of homunculi, you get a finite regress. Eventually you bottom out with homunculi that are so simple they can be replaced by a machine.
Like a cell, maybe.
Yeah, like a cell. In fact, if you look at individual neurons, they're really quite enterprising little cells. So they're not, to replace one of them by a machine is way beyond the capacity of engineers now. But they're parts.
So you would call mechanical. You'd call each one of those a sorta homunculus, but to a lesser degree.
That's right.
The lower
each,
you
one of, each of those several hundred billion neurons is a sorta homunculus. And when you've got proper parts that are that have some serious competence, they can do some interesting cognitive work, when you put them all together, you can get teams and armies that are capable of breaking that mystery of consciousness down into manageable hunks.
So where does the soul go?
The soul remains as an organization. I was once interviewed by a wonderful Italian journalist, Giulio Cerello, and the next day in the Milan paper, the headline was, "Si abbiamo un'anima mai fatta di tanti piccoli robot." Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots. And I thought, bingo, that's it, that's my view. We have a soul in this sense. The organization of those tiny robots is such that it is capable of making responsible, morally responsible decisions, of loving, of remembering, of honoring the law, of being a lovable human being. All the roles that the soul in tradition play are played by this organization of homunculi, this team of little robots. And it differs. The soul of a human being is something that's an organization that no bear or monkey or whale has.
So it's not a thing at all. It's an
organization.
So like if a corporation can be a person, then consciousness can be a committee, let's say,
actually that's not such a wild parallel. Consciousness, we can even imagine cases where we took great large teams of people, put them together into an organization. It has to be the right organization. And there would be a consciousness which was its consciousness, not just the individual consciousnesses of all the people.
You also talk about free will. I haven't got to that section yet, but you have some tools for thinking about free will. I think we have about a minute left. Is that right, Dave? Mm. Yeah, 2 minutes. What about free will?
Well, let's see if I got a, what can I do really quickly? Oh, how about two lotteries?
All right.
Here's two lotteries. And one, the tickets are sold, and then the winning stub is randomly drawn from a big batch of stubs after the tickets are sold. That's lottery A for after. In lottery B, the winning stub is chosen and put in a safe before the tickets are sold. Now the question is, are both lotteries fair? And I think most people agree, yeah, both lotteries are fair. You have as good a chance in one as in the other. Well, but if that's true, then the winning ticket was already determined before you even bought your tickets. How can that be fair? Well, if you think about it, you realize it can be fair. And if determinism is true, then basically all your lottery tickets were chosen before you were even born. But that's all right, because the luck average is out, and everybody's got roughly an equal number of lottery tickets. And you win some, you lose some, but it's all perfectly fair. Determinism isn't so horrible after all. There's no reason to hope that at the moment you decide something, your choice is undetermined.
Well, now I have no choice now, Daniel. We're out of time. So thank you. If you want to know more about all of these topics, Daniel C. Dennett's book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. Thank you, Dan, for a great interview today. And we also want to thank Dave McCann, Buzz Kemper. You can find out more at ffrf.org/news/radio. Call us, become a member. Call us at 1-800-335-4021. And next week we'll be talking with Jerry DeWitt, former Pentecostal preacher who's now an atheist. As Annie Laurie always likes to end the show, tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday